Excellent. Let's wait for a few more people to join and then we will start.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think this is really fascinating, a day with so much happening and so much development as a result of that. And it's really changing on an hourly basis. So many people may not be aware of what's happened today so far. So let's wait for a few more minutes, a couple more minutes, and then we'll kick it off.
Okay, great.
How's your day been, Sam?
Yeah, it's very busy, very busy. So lots of things happening, which is.
And also, let's remember to share with the attendees some exciting news from our side. We'll do that during the course of the session today.
Yes, definitely. Okay, let's see if Guta and others can join us as well. I think Guta was busy with another Clubhouse room. Lots of stuff happening tonight on Clubhouse. So lots of news, but I think the topic that we're going to discuss is quite unique. I haven't seen anyone talking about this. So this is all breaking news. But before we start, let's first introduce the host and the speaker, Dr. Khalid Fatal, who is the founder and chairman of the MLI Group, which is an organization which motto is cybersecurity is no longer the keyword, survivability is. Mr. Fadal has been involved in the global infrastructure of the internet and security of the internet since mid-1990s. He championed it, and if you know, that the internet today can be used in multiple languages, so this is due to the multilingual internet initiative that Khalid Fatal started in the big forums such as United Nations, ITU, ICANN, and many others. So Dr. Fatal is frequently invited to keynote speak at and chair public and private expos, international conferences and events, as well as interviewed on radio and TV stations. So Khalid Fatal also writes regularly for online and print cyber, internet, political and defense publications. He's also a co-founder of this room as well, which is all about cyber war and geopolitical cyber warfare. And I'm sure we'll talk about what is geopolitical cyber and what's the difference between the regular cyber attack and geopolitical cyber attack later on today. So let's see if we can move on now to our main breaking news today. And that is on the Latvian parliament, which has been cyber attacked on the hours after branded Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. So this morning at around 7 a.m. GMT, the Latvian parliament called Seimar issued a statement in which Russian violence against Ukraine was recognized as terrorism and Russia as a country supporting terrorism. In the statement, the Latvian parliament called on the countries of the European Union to immediately suspend the issuance of tourism and entry visas to Russian and Belarusian citizens. Very soon, just literally less than a couple of hours after the announcement of the Latvian parliament, there was another announcement of the cyber attack. So a pro-Russian hacker group known as Killnet took down the website of Latvia's parliament with a message that if you recognize us, I wouldn't read it because there's a lot of profanity in there, but there you go. They took down.
Thank you, Sam.
This office of.
in fact, I think the message was not in English, so please give us the benefit of your ability to translate it, Sam. Thank you.
Not really, but basically, what the Russian hacker group did, they published a screenshot of the web browser in Russian, which says unable to connect to the website. And. In this screenshot, they've also added what they call the proof that they took down Latvian Parliament online resources by providing a link to another website called checkhost.net, which basically checks the availability of a website from different countries in the world. And that indicated that at 9:25 a.m. this morning on Thursday, 11th of August, 2022, and that's GMT time, the website was down. And apparently it was down for a few hours. And that was also published on the official Telegram channel. So, Khalid, let me ask you a question. So this is, I think, fitting with one of your message of geopolicyber warfare. Or can you please expand a little bit?
Yes.
Why do you call this not cyber attack, but a geopolicyber attack?
Thank you, Sam. I think it's fascinating that now, today, we are living in a world that I predicted, and I hate to say I and all that stuff, but unfortunately, we have to call it for what it is. For many of you who may not know, but in 2010 and 2012, I created two definitions, polycyber and geopolycyber. This is because, and I'll tell you what the definitions are in a moment, but this is because my involvement in the global infrastructure of the internet, the security and resiliency of it, and championing making it multilingual, we know a little bit, or maybe a bit more than that, about cybersecurity. And the faults that exist within cybersecurity, the problem was, what I predicted was happening is that cyber attacks were going to plague the world for motivation other than money. Up to that time, virtually all cyber defenses were designed to stop people who are trying to make money from cyber attacks. I predicted there will be, this is why I created the labels polycyber and geopolycyber, that motivation will go beyond financial, there will be political, ideological, religious, terrorism, destruction, devastation, and also the motivation of nation states hacking other nation states to either force them to adopt a new political strategy or force them to adopt economic positions as well. And we're seeing this today, more often than not, these geopolycyber motivated hacks are foundational to so much activity because they're now the tools that are used by nation states either directly or most often through their proxies. And today's Latvian parliament being cyber attacked is 100% geopolitically and geopolycyber motivated, and let me explain why. There was no ransom, there's no motivation to try and make money. It's really a statement by the attackers to say you're opposing our position or what we believe is the just cause in support of the Russian invasion, regardless of whether you believe it's just or unjust. That's their position, and they went and attacked it. In fact, they claim the success to have actually hit by hitting the parliament, which used its legitimacy in state in labeling another country as a state sponsor of terror. This is now becoming the chess game around the world. And for those who may still doubt why that this is by definition a geopolicyber motivated attack, Killnet themselves, as Sam will illustrate this in more detail, were responsible for hacking none other than Lockheed Martin, a major U.S. defense contractor. And if you hack a major U.S. defense contractor, you're really hacking the infrastructure and the apparatus of the U.S. government. So, politically motivated. So you can't just like say this came in for the money or they're trying to steal your Facebook details. So this has now become the theme all over the world. And we could spend hours reciting example after example of geopolicyber motivated hacks. either perpetrated by groups for ideological, religious, or terrorist reasons, or by nation states using their own proxies. So that's really what to give the definition as to why geopolicyber and polycyber are critical. And some of you might ask, well, why is this important? Why do we need to make it to distinguish the difference between a cyber attack or a geopolicyber cyber attack? They're all cyber attacks. The critical difference is not just magnitude, but impact. When you actually attack a nation state and you attack critical national infrastructure, or you could actually hack parliament, you're really hitting the nation state, you're breaking down the country itself. And anybody that thinks that the current cybersecurity strategies and solutions are up for scratch, I really have a bridge to sell you. It's so inexpensive and you're gonna love it. The truth of the matter here is, if you consider that the greatest empire on the planet and the most powerful ever, the United States, which dedicates hundreds of billions of dollars on cybersecurity and strategies, could have the brain of the empire hacked. If you recall, a couple of months before President Trump left office, the communications department in the White House was hacked. More than 150 members of that department's mobile phones, computers were actually hacked. And by the way, that data was not sold on the dark web for money or anything like that. In essence, the hackers were able to determine and learn what the strategies, or if you could call it the ultra strategies, of the empires were. So if you can learn what the ultra strategy of the empire are, you could learn, you could actually make a lot of preparation. So anybody that tells you cybersecurity and cyber strategies and solutions are the way forward, they're totally wrong. That doesn't mean you don't need them. You still need to implement them significantly better than you do. But alone, they are not capable to mitigate current cyber and non-cyber threats. And this is the example today. The Latvian parliament actually paid the price for taking a position. I hope I did not lose you, Sam, or any of the listeners.
No, thank you very much, Khalid, for this. And actually, since you were talking about motivation and money, I would like you to comment another one, which another cyber attack, which was, of course, on the Colonial Pipeline last year, which, as we know, was taken very seriously by the U.S. government as an attack on the national critical infrastructure of the United States. However, as you know, the motivation there appeared to be financial, because the hackers asked for millions and millions of dollars in ransom.
Yes, yeah, of course. Well, you know what? This is very, very interesting. Let me give you, anybody who has watched TV programs or movies where a murder takes place and the investigator checks it out and they find, well, you know, the motive is pretty straightforward, and they then just find, well, hang on a second, this doesn't add up. This is no different. So in many instances, in most instances, a geopolicyber motivated attack may still demand a ransom to give the impression that they are seeking financial rewards. Now the instances, they also, more often than not, they also need to finance their operation. But the key point here, they're not doing it like the drug cartel. They just want to get powerful and rich and become super powerful. So often, when you see a demand for a ransom, do not assume that it is financial motivation. You need to dig a bit deeper and ask yourself, who stands to benefit from such data? Who stands to actually, and if they have this data in their possession, how could they use it to actually leverage or weaken the defense of a nation or an organization? And if you can say what they can do with it for this or for that, clearly the financial, the ransom demand is actually a smokescreen to disguise the true and sinister motivation, which is geopolicyber.
Yeah, thanks for that, Khalid. And actually, can you talk a little bit about the Saudi Aramco incident, where it's also an oil company, and can you draw parallels between that attack, so the colonial pipeline attack, and returning back to the Latvian parliament attack?
You know, but I'm glad you asked that question, and for anybody who's listening, we did not rehearse this, by the way, but Aramco actually was hit on more than one occasion, but the first time was about 10 years ago. And incidentally, I talk about this to great detail in my upcoming book titled Survivability, which will be launched later this month. It's been like almost 3 years in the making. So many of you may recall the Iran nuclear reactor. I think I'm going back maybe 11, 12 years ago, something like that, 10, 11 years ago. The Iranian nuclear reactor was cyber attacked, and the cyber attack, and by the way, all the fingers pointed to Israel and the US, of course, they never accepted, admitted responsibility. But the nuclear reactor the centrifuges started overworking. I'm using now non-technical words, and as a result, there was serious damage to the plant, and it halted the progress of Iran's nuclear ambition. Whether you want to call it peaceful or otherwise, that's up to you. Shortly after, Aramco was hacked. Now, Aramco. The Aramco, for those who don't know, Aramco is the national oil company of Saudi Arabia. It's probably the most powerful and the richest oil company in the world, primarily because it represents the production of the largest producer on the planet. So one day somebody received an email, and as a result, thousands of computer screens were just totally dark. There was no ransom, there was no demand for change of policy. It just literally shut down the entire operation of Aramco. Many claim that it may have been Iran in response to the cyber attack on its nuclear power plant. And as many in cyberspace with the cyber expertise would also acknowledge, that to establish 100% attribution, in other words, who did it, with a high degree of certainty, is a fallacy. Does not work. Does not doesn't exist in the cyberspace today. Like the way you have, for example, in fingerprints. In a regular homicide, that doesn't exist. So a lot of times, to establish attribution, you have to corroborate multiple sources to confirm that the attack came from certain people. In fact, really good hackers can leave some significant breadcrumbs that could lead the investigators to go in one direction versus another. So if you draw the parallel, to answer your question, Sam, you draw the parallel between the Aramco hack, the Iranian nuclear reactor hack, the pipeline in the US, and now the parliament, none of those are financially motivated. They are now the tools of the trade to play your political game. And in that one, unfortunately, unlike, for example, the U.S. has a U.S. defense budget of $780 billion. U.K. has $45 billion. Russia has somewhere around $40 billion. There's a huge difference. So guess what? You can do a lot more. Inside the warfare, David is nothing compared. Goliath is nothing compared to David. If David could actually shut down a city and bring down a country to its knees, and they have, and that's because vulnerability exists all over the place. So to draw that conclusion is, unless nation states or organizations upgrade their cybersecurity strategies and solutions, to what we talk about. So by the way, this is not a pitch for anybody, by the way. I'm not selling any services. And factor in additional processes. They currently do not implement. They're always going to be more vulnerable, and their ability to mitigate will remain so low that their subject and their citizens are subject to the damage and the repercussions of cyber attacks on a daily basis, and we're seeing it every day.
The next question is, around the parliament, right? So we have seen a few parliaments being hacked recently. So last year it was Norwegian parliament, and again Russia was originally blamed. However, later on the blame shifted from Russia to China, which is interesting. So of course I want you to talk a little bit about the Chinese cyber threat as well. Later on, and this was a topic of one of our previous Clubhouse rooms, and replays are available, you can go and listen to that one. This was at the time when Finland announced that they will be joining NATO. So the parliament of Finland was also hacked at the beginning of the Ukrainian war. And now, of course, this morning, where Latvian parliament made another announcement about branding Russia as terrorist state, yet another cyber attack. So, parliaments, disrupting parliaments, disrupting the legislative part of the government. What do these people want, and why do they attack parliaments? And of course, Russia in this case, and interestingly, China in Norway, Norway's case. What can you tell us about these threats? Why these perpetrators are doing this?
You're asking very profound questions, and here's something I want to challenge is, we in the West have always claimed that an attack is by somebody or another person or another group or other country, but we seldom. I'm not aware of when governments point the finger at another government, they actually provide the evidence. And I can understand why they tend to provide the evidence, because then guess what? They're exposing how they come to their conclusion. But quite often, I wonder whether the motivation of these governments is actually factual disclosure or political spin. Today, if you look at COVID, you know, you have certain people in the United States that would call it, as Trump used to, the Chinese virus, if you recall, and wanted to blame China and make them pay for it. Although, if you look at, if you want to go that far, the lab where it actually was supposedly created was financed by the United States government. So my point here is a lot of political spin gets filtered through in attribution and political statements on who's doing what. So going back to the issue of whether Russia did it or China did it, I take a lot of the attribution statements by governments on both sides with a grain of salt until we could sort of like get some validation for ourselves whether this is legitimate or political spin. So going back to the question you asked about China, you wonder, you ask yourself, well, why are they attacking, let's say, parliament? It actually, more importantly, the ability to know, for example, in this case, Latvian parliament went and passed a resolution and labeled Russia a sponsor of terrorism, okay? For the hacker groups, Killnet, to be able to go and hack them within a couple of hours, first of all, I don't think they were just thinking about them for the last 2-3 weeks, sitting around looking at who's vulnerable around the world to see which one to attack. That's all. They probably saw, oh, you want to do this? Let's see what we can do to you. In other words, they probably targeted the Latvian parliament the moment the Latvian parliament made that decision. I'm saying this is highly likely. I'm not saying this is, I don't know this for certain, but it's highly likely. Nobody can focus on everything. So if that's the case, they were successful within a matter of hours to hack the Latvian government. So when you see the official statement of the spokesman of the Latvian government that the compromise did not lead to any damage because of previous security protocols that were implemented. I'm sorry, I'm going to break some rules here. That's bullshit. You were hacked. It means you were compromisable. That means, and you were compromisable within an hour or 2 hours of when the hackers decided to hack you. The hackers could have decided if that the parliament was not hackable, they could have just gone and had a holiday resort and say, oh, this is a retaliation. They could have had the Kentucky Fried Chicken in Latvia and say, this is retaliation. No, they went after the mouthpiece of the legislature of the country within an hour or 2 hours of learning about it. That tells you the security protocols and the best practices and the strategies followed aren't good enough to mitigate these threats. I hope that answers the question. If I missed something, please report it to me.
I want to talk about China as well. You actually brought me to another thing. So obviously what you're actually talking about is that there was a capability to launch an attack against anyone, and that anyone in this case was Latvian parliament, which kind of brings me to
at the moment,
technology of cyber warfare.
At a moment's notice, this is key. I mean, if you can dedicate time and resources, anything is hackable. I can name you numerous examples, but to do it at a moment's notice and say, Latvian parliament did this, let's see if we can do something to Latvian parliament, and they did, that's significant. Sorry to interrupt you, go on, Sam.
No, that's exactly what I wanted to basically expand your thoughts on, is the cyber warfare and type of cyber warfare, and this is exactly what we can call this capability of bringing down systems connected to the internet, right?
In fact,
that was Latvian parliament.
Absolutely. In fact, let me add this as well. In my book, Survivability, coming out later this August, in one of the chapters, it's something that I've been talking about since 2016, 2017. And I call it the silent, undeclared WW3. Now, a lot of people talk about WW3 because we're anticipating, we're fearing, and God forbid it happens, that we're on the brink. We've never been closer to a nuclear confrontation between Russia and the West than what we have since the invasion of Ukraine. And now, when you add more the recent escalation of Pelosi visiting Taiwan, the highest ranking member of US government to ever visit Taiwan, the Chinese took that as a serious insult, and already started military maneuvers in the straits, and that is serious escalation. And all of a sudden now we're saying to ourselves, well, people start calling this as the possible Third World War. The truth of the matter here is Third World War, or World War III, has already been impacting us and happening for at least the last 5 to 6 years. But it is silent and undeclared because in the space of cyber, literally anything you want to do or a nation state that can do, they're doing it. And it's silent. You don't see it. The citizens don't see it. Corporations just discover that they've been hacked and their data compromised and they think, oh, we're just on a cyber attack. And I can shed more light on this in a moment. But the truth of the matter here is this is all part of the tactics of the big dogs trying to make sure the small dogs don't rise to become big dogs. And it's happening all over the place. If you want examples, I'm happy to give examples, Sam, but silent, undeclared World War III is already happening. It's manifesting itself in geopolitical warfare. It's happening on a daily basis. And in fact, we created a clubhouse club in that name, and we're asking all of you to join that club as well while we merge those two clubs together. Examples? You want to hear examples? Sam?
Yes, that would be good to hear some examples.
All right, let's use some examples. Many people may be aware of the cyber attack that hit Marriott, the hotel chain. If you remember, Marriott bought Starwood a few years ago, and they paid close to about $13 billion. Again, I talk about this in extensively in my book, and they did a lot of due diligence on it, but a year or so after it was purchased, they discovered it was hacked. And also the dark part of the hack, the discovery was the hackers had been in the system for 2 years prior to the acquisition. That's one. Now imagine the data of hotel guests staying at hotels all over the world at Starwood and Marriott. By the way, that data represented more than 500 million users. Now, this is now habits of hotel guests and credit card details, etc. Add to that hack the cyber attack that compromised none other than, help me out, Sam, what was the name of that company that custodian of data? Equifax. Yes, Equifax. A few years ago, Equifax was also cyber attacked. 143 million or 147 million records, can't remember the number exactly, I'm going by memory now, compromised. Majority of whom were US citizens. There was about 3 or 4 million that were UK citizens. But here's the difference. The Equifax hack contained data of citizens. That's passports, social security number, passport numbers, birth details, marriages, mortgages.
Yeah, by the way, all the credit history, and Khalid, I think there was I believe there's some news that even President Trump's credit record or...
Absolutely, and this is exactly it. The data of our public officials are included in that. In other words, former presidents, ministers, secretaries, and important people. And here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. Neither data of Equifax nor the data of Marriott was sold on the dark web. So guess what? Who went to all that trouble to sell nothing? My point to you here is, imagine if it's the same groups who hacked both. Now they can marry the data of traveling habits with the data of citizens who are important from Equifax, and imagine the reverse engineering they can do if they wanted to choose a particular target. It's going to be a 4th of July every day, and God forbid they are successful. My point to you here is, this is just an example I would use, which is derived from the public domain, what's been reported. I'm not at liberty to share what's not publicly reported. And imagine the damage it could do to the US, it could do to other countries. Remember, the Marriott breach contained 500,000 records. These are people, who, and many of them are important people from all over the world that could include secretaries, ministers, even presidents of some countries, that now you have data on them. So it's significantly worrisome. And again, cybersecurity strategies and solutions cannot mitigate these threats. So I hope that elaborated it to a decent extent, Sam.
Yes, that's right. Thank you for this. And obviously, you actually reminded me of another example of another attack, which has actually been perpetrated by the same Russian hacking gang, by Killnet, because if you remember, approximately a month ago, they started publishing information that they hacked Lockheed Martin, which is, of course, the U.S. defense contractor, which is currently sending a lot of their military equipment to Ukraine and the Russian Ukraine. So, back then, this was completely, there was no evidence of them actually having done anything like that, because it was just bragging that, hey, we've hacked them. This morning, I think straight after the Latvian parliament, they also published information on the Lockheed Martin employees, which included at least the one that they showed off. included the names, the email addresses, what appear to be telephone numbers of the Lockheed Martin employees. Some of them appear to be the like a main switchboard numbers, but I believe there were some cell phone numbers there as well as some of the password details that were lifted not from the Lockheed Martin website itself, but from other websites where Lockheed Martin employees have registered with their Lockheed Martin email address. Supply the password, and then those sites got hacked and the passwords got leaked.
And this, and I'm glad you're bringing this this particular event up now, Sam, because at the time when they claimed they attacked or they compromised Lockheed Martin, one, no evidence was provided, and everybody thought, well, you know what, they're just bragging. It's like saying, oh my God, see that beautiful woman? Yeah, I dated her. Yeah, really? Yeah, you? But for them to actually post this today is further affirmation and boldness. In other words, they're saying, we did the Latvian parliament, we did Lockheed Martin, and we can do a lot more. And fascinating to me here is, okay, you know, Latvian parliament was compromised. It probably doesn't have the same budget the United States does. But to actually target Lockheed Martin, because Lockheed Martin is supplying weapons to Ukraine in its defense against Russia, that means Lockheed Martin was targeted. And now that they provided proof, it means they were successful. Now, to be able to compromise a Lockheed Martin tells me either you're superiorly good, or Lockheed Martin's defenses are not good enough, or a combination of both is true. Conclusion, cybersecurity alone cannot defend and mitigate these threats. Something else has to be done. So I think, Sam, there's someone who actually requested to speak, SK8FLOW. I don't know what that name is. Please, could you please give them the floor and see? I'd like to hear that.
Xavier, again, if you'd like to add a comment or ask a question, please unmute yourself.
Hi, thanks for having me up for number one. I was using the mic as a feature to agree with the statement you just made. I'm in the telecom.
Oh, I thought you were reminding me that you're waiting. I'm sorry about that.
I also appreciate it. But yeah, you got the name right, Escape Low. That's actually, I'm actually a roller skater. So that is a quick tip. But back to topic, I'm also very into hacking and InfoSec. So, I'm sort of working my way up to being a security researcher, bug bounty hunter, you know, whatever it is I'm going to fall myself into. So this room and hearing what you had to say has been a really, really enlightening experience. I just wanted to say thanks, you know, for dropping off.
Did you say your name is Xavier?
Yes.
Xavier, well, thank you very much. Listen, I mean, part of what we do this is we're not looking for sponsors. We're not looking to make money from this. You know, I've been championing good causes since the mid-90s. My journey in making the global internet multilingual started for many years. I was championing it, and I had not even a single piece of business or interest on the internet. That came many years later. The key of the matter here is I want to educate the general public and decision makers and experts to discover what they don't know above and beyond the gospel that is thrown at us often as fake news. You know, everybody tells you that cybersecurity is the answer for everything, and it's not. Cybersecurity, you still need to do cybersecurity. When we say cybersecurity is not only the keyword, survivability is, we're not disrespecting cybersecurity, but we're saying you still need to do cybersecurity better, but alone it will not mitigate any of the threats we're talking about. You need to implement survivability strategies and consider some of the additional protocols, solutions and reforms to be able to mitigate these threats. And unfortunately, think about it this way. How come the greatest empire on the planet cannot defend the security of the communications of the White House? Is it because they don't have brains? Because they clearly have the smartest people in the world. Do they have money? They have money. They're just using the wrong tools. And they are blind, and they are blind to the stakeholders or the suppliers of these services, and cannot go break the monotony of saying, what else can we do that serves our nation states? They're not. Unfortunately, that's the case. So I'm glad that this is resonating with you, especially that you're excellent at what you're doing. And I think you will find the survivability book even more compelling to start doing different things and maybe giving yourself a new angle on where you can have a distinguish and a competitive advantage in the cyberspace.
Definitely. What I will add, I wonder, you mentioned that cybersecurity won't affect the changes that we need. I would like your opinion on the eighth layer. This is what I've been hearing it us termed as the human layer in cybersecurity. I think that cybersecurity has a tradition, and it is traditionally mentioned, and even some of the buffs say they don't like cybersecurity, more so specifically information security. So myself, I want to be an information security, person. But cybersecurity as a whole is about protecting the data that we have everywhere. So, it's just about protecting that cyberspace and internet. But I think we can affect the change in those policies if they were targeted at assisting the human factors. I think a lot of companies rely on insurance and other fallout methods.
Absolutely right.
That, it doesn't help the human in the end, because we're the victims as, accountants and people that lose the actual money. The banksters are like, hey, workplaces.
Xavier, you're hitting on the money, but let me just add to what you said. What you said is very true, by the way. But what you're proposing is we need to focus on the human element. What we've done with the survivability strategies for the last more than 10 years now, we don't only focus on the human element from the response side, which is where most cybersecurity fails. You're absolutely right. We focus on the motivation from the attacker side. This is where cybersecurity fails to understand. And look, you've learned a lot in cybersecurity, you're involved in it. You will know also that virtually every cybersecurity solution is designed to make the hacker, if they are targeting a particular, target, to make it so difficult for them that the opportunity cost is too high, they go somewhere else. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. This, I've been saying for the last 8-9 years in briefings to board, C-suite, and government officials at the highest level, I always tell them, take that philosophy to the nearest toilet, throw it there and flush twice. This is why your government and your organization continues to get compromised. The reason for that here is, when somebody comes to hack you for political, ideological, so-called religious, and other philosophical motivation, these people often do not have an opportunity cost, brother.
Very true.
They do not have, they're focused on compromise you. So sometimes they stay on you for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks until they get you, because they imagine somebody wants revenge because you've just literally landed a one-ton bomb on him and killed his children. Is this guy looking for money? No, he's looking for revenge.
For revenge on an entire nation.
And that revenge.
Here's
the point. And that revenge, now by the way, often it's revenge and it's sinister, but the world today, there's no such a thing as we are just, we are good, they are evil. There's so much confusion in the middle. You know that. But the point of the matter here is that ethos, that philosophy of cybersecurity models that you create enough to make it difficult for the hacker to go somewhere else no longer works, because you have hackers and attackers that are motivated by something purer than the money in their eyes. Therefore, that strategy doesn't work. So you need to think like what motivates these people and build strategies and solutions to mitigate this. And this is what we do.
I love what you just said. And if you check the chat, I literally, on my screen it said just now, but I'm sure it means by a few seconds now, I was literally waiting to say that. And I think this statement encompasses our best defense will actually be offense. And I mean that in a sense, not going to hack people, but getting offensive about some of those things you mentioned. I don't think that increasing the opportunity cost for someone who wants revenge is possible. But what I do think is attempting to affect the change at that eighth layer that helps make those, to help make it less, you know, of a possibility.
So I what you're talking about?
Impossible is not, you know, possible per se. There's always,
no,
like, I don't know.
Okay. What,
you
know, what was it you just, what was that, what was, you were excited about?
I don't know what you said, but it literally coined into that, I guess for me, it translated into that, but it wasn't your exact words. Like you weren't coining the phrase, but I'm trying to get it. But you were literally saying that like right before I jumped in there. It was literally that last 5 or 10 seconds of your phrasing and your message.
And by the way, Xavier, this is not the first time I say this. I've been saying this for years. It's the ethos why I created the label PolyCyber and GeoPolyCyber, and the reason why we at MLI Group created the survivability strategies and solutions, and why when we talk to governments and nation states, what we offer them and what we help them with is national cyber survivability strategies with a legislative roadmap. So we're going beyond, and critically, it is about the human factor. Case in point, if you just keep it purely about the technology, whether you're securing information or technology, you're still going to get compromised. Don't fool yourself, whether you call it technology or security or information, it doesn't matter. You're still thinking about data. You're still thinking about the tech. You're still thinking about a wall. When you're thinking about survivability, you're now thinking, will I still exist after they're done with me? And even if they don't destroy me, will I remain competitively viable as a government or as a nation state? And I actually challenged ministers, prime ministers, and heads of states who think, no, we're, you know, I say, really? You're a country. You compete just like corporations compete. You compete entertainment. You compete for people to come and do their holidays at your country. What's the word I mean for? I can't remember. Vacationing. You compete for technology. You compete for investment. You want to tell me you don't compete? Of course you compete. And guess what? If your policies do not enhance a better, more secure, forward-thinking plans, why do you think somebody will come and invest with you? By the way, it's no secret.
Now I know why.
So today we now have Survivability News. This is our news extension arm where the stories are. Today, Sam, please drop the story from Survivability News about the hack of the parliament. And please, if you can share with them the link to the upcoming book, Survivability. We have Survivability Wealth Management. We work with financial sector. We work with funds and sovereign funds and mergers and acquisitions, because guess what? They're all, without exception, concluding wrong return on investment, risk calculation, and yields. If I disclose what we know about that market is, the market will tumble. I say no more. So I'm not doing this just for the money. I'm trying to educate the world so that we can have a better place. Last but not least, Xavier, imagine we start focusing on the human element in determining the threat and improving our deterrent from within. How much better would you think we would become more aware of what's going on in the world instead of being so isolated? Did you hear my question, Xavier?
No, sorry, can you repeat that, please?
So yeah, I said, imagine we implemented what you wished for, which is more of the human element in the defense. But what we talk about, we do the human motivation from the outside coming in and from the inside coming out. If we start implementing this as a strategy and create better awareness of how other people feel and think.
And that's exactly the goal.
How much better do you think the world would become? Because then we can develop apathy instead of don't give a damn. Because they're not like us, they're not the same color as us, they don't have the same color eyes. Nuke them. How many times have you heard that shit before?
God, I can't tell you. If I had a nickel, right?
You'll be a millionaire now.
but obviously that's the goal. I think I know what you said earlier that kind of excited me. It was going back to that getting active scene. So for me, the offensive side wasn't necessarily about, like I said, going out and hacking. It was about getting people to be more proactive inside and inside those companies. Because it's not that they won't go for humans like us, but the idea is if they go for any major bank, any major financial health institution, I'd say healthcare has really been getting the most attention because of things that...
Because there's money.
Yeah, right, exactly.
There's money.
They're going for healthcare when it's about, other factors that you can't put a price on. When I can't make your opportunity cost impossible because your goal is different, that's where it's the most dangerous. And I think that that's why it's important to get the mindset out there. Like you said, attack it from both angles. But I think it's going to have to be a harder campaign to the public. And I think that there's the fight that we're having, and even I'm guilty of it, the fight that we're having is we don't understand what cybersecurity is. People think that cybersecurity, obviously, people don't understand that the eighth layer truly is a part of it. And we're just now using it as it'll be a hashtag or it'll be a headline, but it really needs to be the literature soon, like, because that's really been the missing piece, in our cybersecurity food pyramid. We've been missing out on that eighth layer right at the bottom, the biggest one, where you get your proteins and everything that actually strengthens you. We're all eating fruits and vegetables.
Let me share this with you, and I don't do this often, and I'm not name dropping because these are colleagues, these are friends. So many of us, like Vint Cerf, Bob Kahn, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who have been on that journey for more longer than 20 years, some of them have been there for even 30 years. They're friends, they're colleagues. All of us, no exception, when we got involved and we contributed to making the internet what it is today, okay, we all had something beautiful that we were trying to accomplish. All of us, no exception. We all wanted the world to be a better place. We wanted to make it empowering. We wanted the internet to be a tool for alleviating human suffering, information. I championed it becoming multilingual so I could link people who would normally not be able to talk to each other so we can have more understanding and acceptance. Now, how come in 2022, and if you go to Survivability News and you look underneath the revolving window that has the headline stories, it says, never in the history of mankind has man had so much information at their fingertips, yet never before have they been so misled and misinformed. This is where we are today. These are my words. And the problem here is, this is not just about cybersecurity and cyber attacks. Look at fake news. Look at false narratives, which we label as purposed disinformation. This is how you could create hunger in a country in less than a week, purely based on falsehood. Look at the race for quantum supremacy. Look at and all of these things that I can name some of the threats. And all these threats, Xavier, are happening at the same time. So do you really trust the government that you belong to protect you from that, since they failed in being prepared for a precedented threat, which was COVID-19. We all knew COVID was coming. We all knew a pandemic was coming. And I talk about this in my book. And they all failed, especially Western democracies,
who claim to be serving the individual. They all failed us. How do you think they're gonna, how do you think they will deal, how do you think they will succeed in dealing with terrorism, cyber terrorism, quantum computing, fake news, false narratives, purpose disinformation, and et cetera, all at the same time? No chance. The reason I'm talking to you about this is because we need a different system. And it can't happen peacefully unless the public is better informed.
That's it. I totally agree. And you want to know what? I think that there are two things that cybersecurity professionals can do.
Go on.
Number one, I think that we can make things more understandable to the public. In the community right now, and maybe you could speak to this at some point, you know, maybe not today because you have a goal in mind, but the term gatekeeping, I don't want to go any, you know, any further than that, but I think that term implies the veil between cybersecurity professionals and civilians.
Yes.
And I think it appears that way just at a face value, because people that want to get into tech feel like people are gatekeeping, and I think it's because there's a gap there.
You know, Xavier, I don't disagree with you, but I think we'll do this another call and feel free to reach out and add me on LinkedIn and follow me here. We'll have another conversation, you and I, directly.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting part. This would help if it happened. So I want to be positive. But on its own, it isn't going to happen, because unfortunately, cybersecurity experts can only make a living based on who's going to pay them the bill and ask them what to do. And if they don't ask them to do things differently, they're still going to be making the same fried chicken that they're asked for, just the same way the solutions that are implemented by governments all over the world, the same thing. They know they fail, but they keep on implementing them. There's got to be something a bit more different. And we can talk about this in private.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I think that's why I didn't want to go too deep into it. But I think that, you know, to the main point, yeah, I think there's a veil between professionals and civilians and how to help them understand what's so important. And I think that's truly embodied in the fact that CEOs would rather take insurance policies over listen to their penetration testers.
They take the insurance policies so that their jobs are saved. We'll close this conversation with this point, and I'm sure you will agree with me 100% on this one. In many conferences, whenever I'm involved in discussions about artificial intelligence, okay, I always say I hear people all the time talking about how we can make sure that artificial intelligence is not used for bad by making sure that the developers don't do this and don't do that. I say this is all bullshit. The developers are often paid by their institution. No single developer is a philanthropist that has sitting on 100 million and can go develop by themselves. They're all working for somebody. The only way you can make sure that no artificial intelligence is used for bad is that if the top decision makers of these organizations and their governments agree and implement, of course, because then you have to, you know, get into the issue of whether they are sincere or not, agree and implement that no development will be used for other than good purposes. If you agree to that, then the developers will implement what you've told them to implement. Developers, you know, you have a chef in the kitchen who's going to cook what ingredients you give him and what you tell him the meal today is. He's not going to cook as he wishes. So again, it goes back to the ethos. So part of what we do here is changing mindsets. Unless you change the mindset of top decision makers, whether ministers, prime ministers, leaders of nations, corporate leaders, CEO, chairman, boards, these are who our markets are. Unless you change their concepts that it's no longer about cybersecurity, it's about survivability. And unless you switch to survivability and figure out what you are missing in what you're implementing, you're going to be devastated and very, very soon. And often, once they do that, once they recognize it, they say, well, what do we do next? There's no sales pitch, there's no hard press, there's no, pressure. You really need to recognize that what you're doing doesn't work anymore and ask, how can survivability help me? And if you don't do that, nothing will change.
Same thing applies on all of the other things we discussed. But thank you for your interaction, Xavier. I'm pleased. Let's follow up again. Sam, where do we take you?
I think Xavier mentioned some very interesting points. He raised some very, very interesting points around the human element. And of course, the fact that Khalid, you keep talking about the fact that cybersecurity is not the keyword, because as we assume, the people like CEOs, right? And they say, okay, cybersecurity, I just throw a money at it and they will, it's fixed, right? And what they're thinking that cybersecurity is protecting equipment and software and some bunch of wires in the data center, right? And they don't think about the human element and the human.
You know, Sam, I'm glad you brought this up.
The element of attack.
Sam, I'm glad you brought this up because I'm going to give this session a. And by the way, this will be replayed, and I'm going on the record here. And I'm not disrespectful to any public officials, but many of you may recall that the director of the FBI six months ago, was at an event, and he made the statement that we treat ransomware like we treat terrorism. And the world media picked up on it. It became headline news, US, UK, India, whatever, like, you know, I forgot his name. What was his name, the FBI director? Anyway, it'll come to me in a minute. Anyway, that he said that we have to agree that we have to treat ransomware like terrorism. And I find that statement not only misleading, but also counterproductive, and from a public official. And let me explain why. Exactly what you were saying, Sam. There are many CEOs in the US and around the world who listen to the director's words, the FBI director's words, and say, well, hang on a second, guys. The director's saying this. They call in their chief security officer, chief information officer, whoever's in charge, and say, what's going on? Say, yeah, you know, he said it. What do we do? Well, we need more money to buy more ransomware. Okay, how much do you need? 1 million, 2 million, 3 million. Okay, they get more money. And they go and buy more ransomware solutions, thinking they are now good. False. They are now falsely believing they're better protected. They're not, as I described earlier on. And this is where I find if the head of a law enforcement agency can actually accidentally, I would like to say, mislead the public with that statement, then it worries me about the apparatus on the way you recommend and you want stakeholders to better defend themselves so that the nation state is better defended. First of all, adding additional ransomware does not mitigate the terrorist activity or the terrorist motivation. And
ransomware cyber protection, right?
Absolutely. And plus, how would that help any of the events? For example, the Marriott breach. There was no ransomware demand. No ransom demand. What about Equifax? No ransom demand. There's so many events that did not have the ransom demand.
Another very good example, and I think you appreciate it again on the human element and offense and defense. Because if you're starting to be a cybersecurity professional and you mentioned bug bounty, so of course you understand that the way how all the cyber attacks work is through exploitation of a vulnerability, right? But it is what you do with that vulnerability is what matters afterwards. So if you are a what we call a white hat ethical hacker or bug bounty researcher, if you discover vulnerability on, let's say, I don't know, on the Tesla system, right? You go and responsibly report it, and then you wait for it to be fixed, and then the company, as a thank you for discovering this vulnerability,
with
a reward, right?
Yeah.
Because you're doing it. So what you did with a vulnerability, you reported it, right? Then there are other guys who use this vulnerability who break into the system. Then they encrypt all the files on that system, and then say, okay, we'll give you a decryption key back so you can get your data back, and we want $5 million, right? So that's ransomware. That's another thing which can be done with vulnerability.
But there's another way of using vulnerability as a cyber warfare, as a cyber weapon, and I'll give you a real-life example with the war in the Ukraine. Because what happened in the Ukrainian war is that, if you remember, it started from Russian forces launching rocket attacks on Ukrainian military air bases and Ukrainian military installations. Now, weeks before that, there was information that but this information was potentially hacked. So what actually, what it means that Russian state hackers hacked into the Ukrainian Defense Ministry and they stolen data on the location of the Ukrainian military bases. Right?
Correct.
Well, the way how they use this data is that they use this for precise rocket attacks. Okay. But what was very interesting was the retaliation. And this is another human factor. So the attack, there was a loss of human life, of course, because there's all the soldiers and military personnel in Ukraine servicing those military bases that got bombed. But the retaliation was that the Ukrainian hackers, in response, they completely paralyzed the financial system and banking systems. I mean, because you mentioned finance and banking. Mm-hmm. So what happened in the morning after, when Russians went to work and they tried to pay for their taxes, pay for the breakfasts and lunches, and get some cash out of ATM machines, they were unable to do so.
Correct.
And the Russians who were driving electric vehicles, like Tesla and others, and they tried to charge their cars with electricity so they could drive to work, they couldn't, because all the charging stations, they displayed a message in Russian saying, you're not getting any charge because this is hacked by the Ukrainians. So this is the offense, defense, and Khalid, I actually want your comment on that, because that is like a pure example of cyber war and the use of vulnerability for different purposes. While the Ukrainian side exploited the vulnerability to paralyze the financial system. And again, you can think, okay, it's just a piece of software, right? I sold the cybersecurity, but here we can see actually the human element and what can be done if the vulnerability and the cyber weapon is used in a way which has nothing to do with ransomware, nothing to do with money.
Totally. In fact, you know, I'll make it very, very simple to add on all this. And most people don't realize why these cybersecurity strategies that are currently followed like gospel today don't work. Talking about the way you describe vulnerability is absolutely right. But most people don't take on board or realize, I'm sure Xavier will probably recognize this, I'm sure he knows this, that what may not be a vulnerability today might become a discovered vulnerability next week. In other words, vulnerabilities get discovered all the time. But then, what do you do with it? The concept here from our point, from our survivability angle here, is you need to find those vulnerabilities before the bad people do, whether they're financial motivated or 2.7 motivated, okay? You're exposed. So, how many companies do you know? This is a rhetorical question, you don't have to answer it, by the way. Think about it, of how many companies that you know that do an internal or external cyber defense or audit of their vulnerabilities, what, once every 3 months, once every 6 months, once every year? The way we operate with our clients, we say you need to do this 24/7. Your people, your ethical hackers have to operate from within. You know, we recommend that they become your own employees. They're constantly on the lookout for vulnerabilities so that you can identify those vulnerabilities and patch them before the bad actors do. And therefore, you elevate your survivability defense to the next level. And there aren't many companies that do this today. This is the sad truth. This is the sad reality. And they claim they are doing this. Last but not least, and I think we need to close this session today relatively soon. Many of us, or many of the listeners, would recognize GDPR, the European Union General Data Protection Law, which came in a few years ago, which was touted as the greatest privacy law in the world. Well, I'll tell you what, I talk about this also excessively in my book. If many of you would know that that ethos came up purely for first so that European companies would elevate their cyber security hygiene to another level. Unfortunately, what ended up happening is it became so diluted. And if I share with you how many abbreviations or modifications to the text of that law happened over the 10-year period that it went through to be assessed, you would be shocked. If any of you are saying 200, 300, no, 4,000 versions. All of it was with the help, of course, of the tech companies who were helping the regulators and the drafters with their goodwill. What ended up happening is now you have a GDPR law within the EU that has become nothing more than a checkbox exercise so that if you get hacked, you have a reasonable defense not to be punished. Very few companies have actually elevated the cyber defense because as a result of implementing GDPR. And that's part of the sad truth. So on this one, is there anything else we need to add, Sam?
Since you are talking about GDPR, Khalid, an interesting example, which I read in your book as well, of course, I know about it very well, is the British Airways hack, because it came in just a few months after GDPR was already implemented as a law, right, in the United Kingdom. And the interesting thing about GDPR, what I want to, of course, ask you a question about, and of course, you're absolutely right in the way that it became diluted and a checkbox exercise. However, I think there was something valuable in there, and of course, I want you to expand on this. And this was the obligation on the companies to report data breaches to the authorities.
Correct.
Because prior to this legislation, nor in Europe and not anywhere else in the world was there a legislation saying, okay, company XYZ, it doesn't matter if you're a bank, if you're a pipeline, if you're a government agency, or if you're whoever you are, or a hotel chain, if you get hacked, you have to report it to the authority if any data was leaked or any data was stolen. I think that is the biggest value that GDPR has brought. And Khalid, I want you to comment on this. Of course, I know you're...
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, let's put it this way. The world is a better place with GDPR in place today.
It's visibility.
However,
it was undetected, and as you say, declared cyber war.
Yeah, let me just add this point here is, and I use the analogy, it might be offensive to some people. Imagine a man that beats his wife, but now he's beating her less per week, so she should be thankful. You see how horrible that example is. However, GDPR's purpose was not to create just visibility. Unfortunately, well, luckily, that visibility remained in the text because certain legislators were demanding it stays there while a lot of the other stuff got watered down. So at least for a change, the stakeholders had to report if they are breached, and that was not the case. So at least the world today is in a better place with GDPR to be in. Although it had the chance to be far more significant, that's what I was trying to say. Now, when you look at other countries that don't implement GDPR, there are many cases of, you talk about British Airways, okay. British Airways was hacked twice, believe it or not. But more interestingly, there are many airlines that belong to national governments in other parts of the world, and they were hacked, and guess what? They're not going to get a report of their hacking because it belongs to the government. There's no obligation to reporting it. So we could take that lesson from that. I wish that GDPR had lived up to its promise. It didn't, but it's definitely better than what we had before. Anything else before we start wrapping up, Sam?
Thanks, Khaled. I just want to bring to well, ask you about something else, which I think probably will be perfect for the conclusion of the session. Oh. So again, going back to the British Airways, because obviously one of the interesting things here was the interview with a conversation with the CEO of the airline company, and basically where you asked them that which industry they operate in.
Well, no, that's a good one. Okay, let me just be clarify here. A client of ours, which is not British Airways, but it's an airline, and they had implemented a couple of the pillars and the survivability, blah blah blah. And he and I were having a conversation one time, and then I asked the question. I said, you know, what you know, when people ask you what you do and what sector do you operate in, what do you tell them? And he said, oh yeah, I say, you know, I'm a CEO. We are in the airline industry. I said, but based on what we know, because we've worked with them already, I said, look, your revenues are 96% coming from internet. And you know, you may want to reconsider what industry you operate. You're predominantly an internet company that operates in the transportation sector. Because if you think about it that way, you are more likely to allocate appropriate resources to defend that 96% revenue more than what you are appropriating now, because any dip in percentage from that revenue as a result of internet outages or cyber attacks, whether on you or a service provider, could have dramatic impact on your share value, on your profits and losses, et cetera, et cetera. And he looked at me and said, you know, I mean, he was, first of all, very positive in the reply, bewildered. And in a tongue-in-cheek, he was saying, you know, couldn't you let me enjoy the dinner before you hit me with this? But the point of the matter here is he took it on board and he recognized it, and he did something about it. But thank you for bringing this out, Sam. And it was not British Airways, by the way, just to be clear.
Yes, thank you very much, Khaled. I think this is a very good example of the reason why it is important, and why survivability that you talk about is so important, and why the impact of the cyber attacks needs to be reviewed and understood completely differently. Because as you say, the companies today are so reliant on the internet, they will not be able to survive. As in your example with the airline, in your example, which said 96% of the business depends on the internet, if the internet access was shut down for just a few hours for that airline, they just wouldn't be able to operate. And the same.
And by the way, just for the record, you know, when people go and into a, even if people go into a travel shop, a travel agency, and they want to buy a ticket on that airline, when they put their credit card and they're swiping it, that transaction often goes through internet service providers. So it doesn't mean that internet needs has to be shut down from your computer. We are in such interdependency today in our lives on internet services, it's a miracle that we don't get more shutdowns. Seriously. And it's the gaps of vulnerabilities that allows exploiters to leverage is huge. So it's virtually a minefield to think about what else needs to be done, but you gotta start somewhere and make sure that your house is in order. And then hopefully if more people take care of their houses, the neighborhood is safer. And that's what I use the example for, how nation states can elevate their cyber survivability and cyber defense to a new level with our survivability strategies.
Excellent. Thank you very much for an amazing conversation today, Khaled. Learned a lot.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you all. Follow us on Survivability News, and feel free to. I've just dropped the link to my upcoming book, Survivability. Check it out. register for updates. You'll get the date of launch. I'm embarking on an international book signing tour, literally all over the world. We already have invitations from stakeholders to come to different parts of the world. There'll be some briefings, some of them private, some of them public. I'll be speaking at major expos and conferences, so it's exciting times. And I just want to spread the gospel.
Thank you very much.
Alrighty. Well, thank you all for listening. Until the next time, stay tuned. I think there'll be some more interesting stories to come up for us to talk about. And hopefully you've learned something new that you did not know and that could help you in your personal and professional life moving forward. Take care and goodbye.